Let's bring in NPR Scott Horsley, who was actually at the scene there in Chicago. And Scott, I couldn't help but think that this speech, in many ways, as Mara alluded to, was kind of a hybrid Obama speech, shades of Obama from 2008, but also Obama the realist. You know, almost hardened by 4 years of being in the White House. What was your sense?
Well, not only has he been hardened by that experience, but his supporters have been hardened by it as well. You know, there was a lot of talk during this campaign that the enthusiasm was not there, that young people or the coalition that he built in 2008 would not be there for him. And one thing the campaign has always said is that, you know, the enthusiasm is still there, but it's a more sober enthusiasm, or a mature enthusiasm, to use Mara's word. These are people who recognize that it's going to take more than a single election or a single term to make the kinds of changes that they want. And certainly it's a little odd to say that we're more than a sum of red states and blue states on a night when we've all been watching the colors appear on the electoral map. But obviously this is something that the president has thought long and hard about. How do you get beyond those divisions? Recognize that we are a divided country. We're never going to have perfect consensus on these things. But how do we find those areas where we do have common aspirations and do, as he talked about, the hard work of building consensus?
Scott, we can hear Bruce Springsteen's music playing behind you, and we're watching these scenes of confetti falling on the president and the first lady and his family and supporters. Let's move to E.J. Dionne here in the studio. With us, EJ, something the president said very clearly. He said compromises are going to have to be made to move the country forward. He said this very explicitly in his speech.
And that's right. I mean, in a divided government with the Republicans holding their majority in the House of Representatives, there will be no alternative. And I think that was both an open hand, but it was also a challenge, because for the last 2 years, the Republicans have essentially refused. They've used the filibuster in the Senate, and obviously the House Republicans have been resistant. And so the question is, having won a kind of mandate here, it's not a mandate in the traditional sense. It's a mandate, as we were talking about earlier, of someone who won a big argument with the guys and women who were trying to stop him. The other thing that was striking about this speech was how deeply communitarian it was, if I can use that word. I mean, the words he kept using, a generous, compassionate, tolerant nation. We talk about not what can be done for us, but what can be done by us, which I thought was the most memorable part of the speech. And the very music we just heard, that Bruce Springsteen song, where the refrain is, wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own. From the moment that song came out, it felt like a campaign song for the kind of argument that Obama made in the campaign and is going to try to make for 4 years.
EJ, and to you, Mara, we heard him talk about the long journey. The road was hard. He talked about the red states and the blue states and the shape of peace, a generous America, a tolerant America, some sweeping language here. But when he came to policy, he talked about the tax system, foreign oil, or ending our dependence on foreign oil, and reforming the immigration system in America. Obviously, all ambitious goals, but not like in 2008 when he was talking about stopping the rising of the seas.
Although he did talk about the destructive power of a warming planet, which I think is a real signal.
But I think the big difference is he's not talking about a big new entitlement. He's not talking about giving people stuff in the way Republicans would describe it. He's talking about reforming things, and some of that is going to have to do with retrenchment and cutting back and a little bit of austerity to make room for investments in the things he wants to invest in, like education and infrastructure and energy. This is a whole different thing. I mean, you could say that healthcare reform represented the end of the great New Deal liberal project. It was the last middle-class entitlement. They're not going to be anymore. And now everybody is going to have to sacrifice something in order to solve these problems. It's a totally different kind of agenda than he ran on in 2008.
And Michael Dimmick at the Pew Research Center for People in the Press, the president also sort of talked about the economy and people feeling optimistic. Did that optimism actually bear out in the exit polls?
You know, a little bit. About 40% of people today told us that they thought the economy was getting better. 30% thought it was getting worse. So that's a slightly positive balance. I think what's more telling is that people who feel like they've stagnated, people who think they're no better off or worse off than they were 4 years ago, voted for Obama. He won those people kind of who are about the economic situation. They're giving him a pass to kind of carry the ball a little bit further.
You are listening to special coverage from NPR News. We're going to have more analysis in a little bit. Talk about, to recap the race, we just heard from President Barack Obama giving his victory speech in Chicago. We'll hear some clips of that again later. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Audie Cornish. President Obama, a short while ago, went before his hometown supporters in Chicago to thank them for their help in winning a second term in the White House.
Some of you were new this time around, and some of you have been at my side since the very beginning. But all of you are family. No matter what you do or where you go from here, you will carry the memory of the history we made together. And you will have the lifelong appreciation of a grateful president. Thank you for believing all the way to every hill, to every valley. You lifted me up the whole way, and I will always be grateful.
That's the president spoke less than an hour after his Republican challenger, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, went before his supporters in Boston to concede defeat.
I so wish that I had been able to fulfill your hopes to lead the country in a different direction, but the nation chose another leader, and so Ann and I join with you to earnestly pray for him and for this great nation.
NPR's Howard Berkus has been following the election returns in Salt Lake City with Utah Republicans. Hi there, Howard.
Hi there.
So can you talk here? You have some news for us, maybe one of these congressional races.
Well, the congressional race of great interest here in Utah, featuring six-term incumbent Jim Matheson and Mia Love, the Republican who would have become the first black woman Republican in the House of Representatives. That race appears to be over with 100% of the precincts reporting. And this is reported by the state elections office. Jim Matheson has a 3,000-vote lead over Mia Love. It's 49% to 48%.
Mia Love, very much a sort of rock star name. People talked about this election cycle. In the end, do you have any sense about sort of where her message may have fallen short?
Well, this is a tough district to begin with, both for a Democrat and a Republican. Despite the attempt of the state legislature to make it more of a Republican district, it does include parts of Democratic Salt Lake County. And Mia Love, even though she tied herself to Mitt Romney, which would be a very popular thing to do in this state, he had 70% of the vote in this state, Jim Matheson is a very conservative Democrat. He has won public Republican support in the past. He can't win without that crossover support. And Mia Love took positions that some moderate Republicans may have been scared away from. She wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. She wanted to cut funding for student loans and grants for students, federal grants for students, and other programs that I think moderate Republicans might have been scared about. So, you know, Jim Matheson ekes out. Apparently, Jim Matheson, you know, at least as we have the reporting now, has more votes again.
And Howard, I was going to interrupt you to ask about the Utah Senate race, which wasn't as controversial, but it seemed like Senator Orrin Hatch really learning some lessons from 2010.
Well, you know, that lesson was learned back in, during the state convention a number of months ago, back in the spring, when a Tea Party sort of infused revolt forced him into a primary, the first primary he faced ever. But, you know, once he went into that primary and the vote went out to the general Republican electorate here, he easily won the primary. He easily won tonight. Maybe the lesson is don't take anything for granted and make sure your organization is in place. And he did a bang-up job of organizing, and so he had his support in place when he really needed it.
That's NPR's Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City, Utah.
In Wisconsin, a victory for perhaps for the labor movement with the victory of Tammy Baldwin, the Democrat who was running for the U.S. Senate against former Governor Tommy Thompson, two popular politicians in that state. Let's bring in NPR's David Shaper, who is in Madison, Wisconsin. David, just a few months ago in that same city where you are, supporters of opponents of Governor Scott Walker, labor unions and others, suffered a defeat when they failed to recall Governor Walker. Does the labor movement see what happened in Wisconsin tonight as a vindication or victory or something, you know, to that effect?
Certainly a victory and certainly a little bit of vindication, I believe. It's interesting because it was such a solid defeat for the Democrats and for the labor movement in particular just 5 months ago when Scott Walker was able to defeat the recall movement against him and remain in office. And certainly organized labor was solidly behind the president's effort in this state and very an integral part of Tammy Baldwin's campaign in terms of getting out the vote and spending in support of her candidacy. But, you know, when it really came down to it, this was an election that was much broader than what we saw in the recall election. This was an election about issues that went far beyond just the labor movement and public employee unions in particular. So I think it's really too soon to say that this is a complete vindication for labor. Mm. This is going to be a struggle in this state for quite some time.
David, I should note you are at a Democratic Party event in Wisconsin, and it sounds like they're packing everything up and the bleachers are being put away. It doesn't sound like much of a party there. It is about 2:15 a.m. Eastern time, but seems like the celebrations are over.
It certainly has been a raucous night here, but yeah, we're the only ones left.
All right, well, hopefully you get some sleep soon. That's NPR's David Shaper in Madison, Wisconsin.
Thanks, Guy.
We turn to NPR's Ted Robbins now. He's in Phoenix, Arizona. And, Ted, we don't have all the answers yet in terms of some of these House races, but there's been a lot of talk about the changing demographics in Arizona. Did we see anything kind of bear out in these races?
You know, I should add that it's a good thing that Dave. Now I don't feel so alone because we are also the only ones here.
Am I going to hear these also, sweet music of folding chairs in a minute?
You are indeed. Good night. Good night. They're waving at us.
Yes. As long as they aren't janitors, you're all good.
Yeah.
Right. So the question is. Is the Latino vote? And I can tell you, you know, this was the question was, would this be the election where Latinos turned out in such numbers that they changed the pardon the pun complexion of the races? And I don't think that you can say that. Nationally, they made up 10% of the vote, which is up slightly from 4 years ago, which was 9%. President Obama nationally carried 69% compared with 67% 4 years ago. But we did follow around for some of the day today some DREAM Act activists who are actually out getting voters who will support candidates who will vote for the DREAM Act, which is, of course, the legislation which would allow a path to citizenship for those brought here as youngsters illegally. I saw more of that than I've ever seen here. I saw a fight against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who has been fighting illegal immigration, but he still won. So no, I don't think you can say that the scale has tipped yet. But here's the thing. Jeff Flake, who won the Senate here, the open Senate seat, is a
long-time incumbent in the House.
Right. In the House. And he was, in the House, a co-sponsor of DREAM Act-like legislation with Congressman Luis Gutierrez, a Democrat. He says it's time to start thinking about that again, to start thinking about bipartisan support for comprehensive immigration
and
reform.
And he says that from the safety of a win at this point, right?
Indeed, but you know that's been the fight all along. It's been within the Republican Party. The Democrats, and in fact President George W. Bush, had favored this kind of bipartisan legislation. And it was the Republican Party who so far has said enforcement only. So we'll see if the, like you say, Audie, it's from the position of a win tonight. We'll see if that translates, because I think, you know, everybody's realizing that something has to be done along with enforcement. At least that's what I'm hearing tonight.
That's NPR's Ted Robbins in Phoenix, Arizona.
Let's bring in NPR's SV Date, who is our congressional editor, Sharish. Let's talk about the $6 billion campaign, a minor or not so minor stimulus for states like Virginia, Ohio, Nevada. Talk about the money in this race and what it ultimately meant.
Well, the candidates decided, both of them, not to take public financing, and so there was $1 billion per side just from the President Obama's side and then also from Governor Romney's. Did it get them a campaign that was six times better than the previous campaigns? Well, that's in the eye of the beholder. Certainly the TV stations liked it. The other big part about this year was the outside money, $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion in outside money between the super PACs, the tax exempt groups, the U.S. Chamber.
Most of that money pro GOP.
The vast majority of it was trying to defeat President Obama and then the Democratic Senate candidates. And tomorrow morning, the folks who are funding all that are going to wake up, and things are going to be pretty much exactly like they were yesterday.
Made a lot of consultants and. Strategists and image folks are very rich.
It did indeed. Now, but the money came from perhaps billionaires, millionaires, that number in the dozens. It's a small group of people, and are they going to be ready to open their checkbooks again in 4 years or in 2 years' time? We'll have to wait and see, but that's a lot of money that didn't produce a whole lot of results this time around.
Didn't produce results this time, but quite possibly set the stage for doing it once again in 2 years from now.
Absolutely, but next time around, maybe the Democratic donors will be more ready to open up their checkbooks. So,
and I'm sure we'll be talking about it for the next 2 years. Sharish, that's NPR's SV Date, our congressional editor. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012. You're listening to NPR. You can also go to npr.org for more. Stay with us. We'll be right back in a moment.
Support for NPR's election coverage comes from Nissan, featuring the all-new Nissan Altima with 38 miles per gallon highway. Nissan, innovation that excites. From CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And from America's Natural Gas Alliance, supplying domestic energy while working to protect the environment. Learn more at anga.us. This is NPR.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Guy Raz. The 2012 election is nearing an end. In Chicago a short while ago, President Obama declared victory in front of a crowd of supporters.
I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time.
President Obama outlined his agenda for a second term. He said he would reduce the nation's federal deficit, fix the tax code and immigration, and reduce the nation's dependence on foreign oil.
Now, one of the defining issues of the campaign was health care, and it looks like the president's health overhaul will continue as scheduled.
We turn now to NPR's Julie Robner to talk more about that. Julie, all I've heard for the last 2 years is repeal health care. Between the Supreme Court ruling and now this election, is that going to put that to rest?
Probably, but not necessarily. This certainly seemed to be the last really big hurdle that the 2010 healthcare law had to overcome. Obviously, first was the Supreme Court back in June when they said that a bare majority said that the central tenet of that law, the requirement that most people either have health insurance or pay a fine, was constitutional. Then the states sort of who were in charge of putting a lot of this into effect went back and said, well, now we're not so sure we're going to do anything. We're going to wait and see whether or not Mitt Romney gets elected to repeal the law. And that did not happen. So now the clock starts to tick. States only have 10 days to decide whether or not they're going to put together their own health exchanges. They have to tell the federal government by November 16th if they're going to run those exchanges or let the federal government do it.
And there were several health-related ballot issues across the country. Can you tell us about any of those, how they fared?
There were. Interestingly enough, you had a lot of states, as we've known that part of the health law that requires most people to have health insurance has not been very popular. And indeed, that there were several basically non-binding referendum that said, do you want your state to not have to do this? And they all passed, as they have in several states before, I think except the one in, I believe it was Florida, where it needed 60%. But in Missouri, interestingly enough, they reelected their Democratic governor, but they also amended their constitution to say that, no, we will not have our own health exchange. So
the resistance is still still fighting it out.
That's right. There's still, the law is going to go forward, but nobody said this was going to be easy.
And are we going to be hearing more about this kind of Medicaid, Medicare battle, I imagine, with Congressman Ryan going back to the House as budget chief, that we will?
That's right. And that's, a separate issue. That has more to do with deficit reduction and dealing with the budget and figuring out what to do about entitlement spending writ large. The Affordable Care Act took a little bit of a down payment on that in terms of Medicare, in terms of trying to slow the spending of Medicare. But obviously, I think everybody agreed that more needed to be done. And I think there will be a new look at that starting with the next Congress. I think even the president agrees that there's more to do on that front. Slowing the growth of health care costs is obviously going to be very important.
Health policy correspondent Julie Robner, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's go now to NPR's Ina Jaffe in Las Vegas, Nevada. Ina, we are still waiting for that cliffhanger of a race between Shelley Berkley and Dean Heller for the Senate seat in Nevada. That was a very, very tough race. What do we know at this hour?
It's still less than 1%.
Wow.
Of the difference between the two of them. And right now, Dean Heller, the incumbent senator, is leading.
He is leading right now. It was a tough race. Shelley Berkley under investigation by the House for an alleged ethics violation. Dean Heller used that against her. Shelley Berkley spent a lot of money, had Harry Reid help her out. Seems like there's evidence that Harry Reid's so-called Nevada machine has indeed been helpful for Shelley Berkley.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that last part. She was really helped by that. You would think that, and the Heller campaign expected to be able to put her away a lot earlier than this because of that ethics investigation. Specifically, it was over her coming to the aid of a kidney transplant program that was in danger of being shut down, and she rescued that. Now, it turns out that her husband is a physician. He is a kidney specialist and stood to benefit, and did benefit financially from the fact that the kidney center remained open. On the other hand, Some Nevada voters, especially in the South, in Clark County, where she's from, where this kidney transplant center was, may feel that she was doing well by doing good because they needed the facility there.
That's NPR's Ina Jaffe in Las Vegas, Nevada. Ina, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Let's turn now to NPR's Ken Rudin. Ken, what happened in the last in the last few weeks? There was talk about great momentum for Mitt Romney. What went wrong for him?
Well,
what went right for the president?
Well, you can make the case that the momentum did start for Romney October 3rd in the first debate, the presidential debate in Denver. You could also make the case that perhaps that momentum ended with the advent of Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. It just seems like President Obama was everywhere. He was in some ways quasi-endorsed, not really, of course, by Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. And Mitt Romney couldn't buy airtime. He couldn't buy coverage time. Everything was the president being presidential. Now, is he also the campaigner-in-chief? Of course. And did he benefit by this terrible tragedy? Politically, yes, he did. But I think Romney just couldn't catch his bearings, and he just couldn't make up that time.
Mm. Ron Elving, tell us a little bit about some of the trends we're seeing in terms of the Southwest. I mean, I can't help but look out at Arizona and Utah and try and divine what's going on for the parties there.
You know, if you look back at the maps of the 1980s and early 1990s, and if you looked at the map tonight and you see Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, New Mexico, and Colorado all going for the Democrat, along with Hawaii, of course. When you think about the 80s, when these were pretty solid Republican states and the basis really for Ronald Reagan's landslides, which started in the West and went east, as opposed to our usual political dynamics, to see all those states in blue tonight, the common factor among all of those states, and it's in varying degrees from state to state, is the Hispanic vote and the transformation of American politics by the rise of a new group that has not been particularly a block voting group in the past and has not been a particularly large group, but now is nearing the size of the African-American vote. And while it does not vote as much as a group as the black vote, is not quite as monolithic, it's approaching that. In some states, we saw 75% of the non-Cuban Hispanic vote, for example, in Florida, going for Barack Obama. That is an enormous advantage when that fast-growing group is all voting one way.
Ron Elving, Ken Rudin, stand by. We will have much, much more from you in just a moment. After the break, you're listening to special coverage from NPR News, of course, about election night 2012. Stay with us and also check out NPR.org for more.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Guy Raz. With a hard-earned win, President Obama strikes a conciliatory note.
I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together.
It's special coverage from NPR News. Back again with our political junkie, Ken Rudin and Ron Elving. You guys talk a little bit more about, I hate to do this, turn it on the prognosticators. Like, what happened here with the numbers? It seems like the pollsters and the statisticians became the news this time around.
And a victory for Nate Silver from the New York Times, we should say, who predicted that the president will receive 310 electoral votes. It appears if he wins Florida, he'll receive many more than that.
Yeah, he could be at 332 electoral votes, a pretty astonishing figure given where we were just 24 hours ago, uncertain who would win the Electoral College, uncertain who would win the popular vote. And Nate Silver was never uncertain. Back months and months and months, no matter what happened, the rise and fall of these two candidates, Nate Silver kept saying, it's going to be President Obama, and he's going to win pretty easily, and here's how many electoral votes he's going to get. And a lot of people thought, there's something wrong with this guy.
Yeah. And so what does it say about polling?
But in fairness, I mean, if you look at all the swing state polling, President Obama did have a lead in all those states, albeit by
tiny,
a small amount.
Small.
But everyone, there was no, except for North Carolina, Romney didn't have a lead in any of those states. So to blame Nate Silver or to blame the pollsters for that, and I wonder if that's why some of the Republicans were talking about the Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota towards the end, thinking, well, let me distract from these bad polling numbers and let's look at these possible other opportunities, which ultimately turned out to be a bluff.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about the popular vote for a moment, because it appears as if the president may win the popular vote by about 2.5 to 3%. It would mean that he would be the fourth president in history, sitting president, to be reelected with less than 5% of the popular vote.
You mean
with less than 5% of
margin
of victory? Forgive me. Yes.
That's right. But on the other hand, it's not been certain until just the last few hours, really, that the president was even going to win the popular vote. George W. Bush in 2004 did a little bit better.
2.4%, I think, was his margin.
But not nearly as well in the Electoral College.
Yeah.
And I would think that you would have to look at the fact that this is not only the first American, African-American president to be reelected, but the first Democratic president to finish over 50% twice since FDR, okay? Because Bill Clinton never got over 50%, and only LBJ, really, in the era since FDR, has had more than 50%
as a Democrat
president
yeah.
in a first election or a second election. And this being his second election over 50%, albeit barely, he is the first Democrat to achieve that since FDR.
But it's not an aberration to see a very close presidential race in the popular vote and see an Electoral College landslide. In 1960, John F. Kennedy beat Richard Nixon by maybe 100,000 votes, and yet Kennedy had over 300 votes in the Electoral College, so it doesn't always translate the same way.
And just to be fair to Bill Clinton, he ran against two other candidates both times.
That is correct, and he might very well have done a little better with just one.
Ron and Ken, stand by, and I think we're going to Audie, to Netta Willoughby.
Hey, Netta, are you there?
Hi, I sure am.
Speaking to us from Fargo in North Dakota.
I am surrounded by a bunch of deeply frustrated North Dakotans.
I was going to ask, are we there yet?
We are so far from being there. I'm almost tempted to make you guess how close this race is, because it just feels like a cruel joke. It is 49% to 50%, with Heidi Heitkamp having the narrowest of leads.
And that's with many, 99% of the precincts reporting. Can you tell us right now sort of what's going on at Berg headquarters? I mean, any sign anyone's coming out? Anyone trying to even spin the situation?
Yeah, apparently at both headquarters, reporters are clustered around waiting to ambush the candidates as they will come out, apparently within the next 10 minutes or so, and say something. Everyone is pretty much expecting talk of a recount.
What are the rules there in the state? Do you have any sense of sort of what that could mean?
You know, most of the talk that people are most of the things people are talking about here is, you know, how this kind of came to pass. Everyone knew that it was going to be a tight race. This time, maybe not so much. And one of the things that could be going on is an influx of new workers to North Carolina. As you probably know, the economy is booming here. There's the lowest unemployment rate in the United States. The situation is so good that there are stories about McDonald's at the oil fields giving people $300 signing bonuses and paying $18 an hour. This is a really good economy. And they may have tipped the scales.
Netta, thanks so much. We're going to continue the conversation. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The votes are counted and the results are in.
President Barack Obama has held on to his job as President of the United States.
The political terrain in Washington will be familiar to the president.
He'll still have a slim Democratic majority, I should say, in the Senate, and he will still face a GOP majority in the House.
NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving and political editor Ken Rudin are with us here in the studio. And, guys, I want to point out something really briefly. A quote from the National Republican Senate Committee Chairman John Cornyn of Texas: we have a period of reflection and recalibration ahead for the Republican Party.
Oh, my. Poor John Cornyn. Let's have a moment of sympathy for him. He was the chairman of the Republican Senatorial Committee in a year when they were supposed to pick up 5, 6, 7 seats. It was all baked in the cake. No one thought there was any way they could lose, and they were going to be the majority party in the Senate. And that was as recently as in the spring. And then they had a series of reversals, people who retired, people who lost their primaries who were the better candidates, like Richard Lugar in Indiana. Then they had some of the candidates that they had say some disastrous things about rape and abortion and so forth. And they just had a lot of reversals of fortune in the last 6 or 8 months. And they spent an absolutely astonishing amount of money, not just the campaigns and the candidates, but this outside money that everybody's been talking about by Karl Rove's group and a lot of other people, much of which was targeted at these Senate races.
So what happened?
Well, that's what's so surprising about the whole thing. The outside money spent a fortune to try to defeat Sherrod Brown in Ohio, yet that race wasn't even close. Tom Smith in Pennsylvania, the Republican nominee there, spent a fortune of his own money trying to beat Bob Casey. That race wasn't close. It's just interesting how so many things, how much money was coming in to try to make this a Republican majority, and yet on many of the races they focused on, it really wasn't close at all.
Very tough night from the top of the ticket on down. We're going to take another listen now to Governor Romney's concession speech, delivered just before 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Crowd gathered at Romney's campaign headquarters in downtown Boston had been subdued for hours, and finally they cheered as their candidate took the stage one last time.
Thank you. I have just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations. I wish all of them well, but particularly the President, the First Lady, and their daughters. This is a time of great challenges for America, and I pray that the president will be successful in guiding our nation. I want to thank Paul Ryan for all that he has done for our campaign. And for our country. Besides my wife, Ann, Paul is the best choice I've ever made. And I trust that his intellect and his hard work and his commitment to principle will continue to contribute to the good of our nation. I also want to thank Ann, the love of my life. She would have been a wonderful first lady. She has been that and more to me and to our family and to the many people that she has touched with her compassion and her care. I thank my sons for their tireless work in behalf of the campaign and thank their wives and children for taking up the slack as their husbands and dads have spent so many weeks away from home. I want to thank Matt Rhodes and the dedicated campaign team he led. They have made an extraordinary effort, not just for me, but also for the country that we love. And to you here tonight, and to the team across the country, the volunteers, the fundraisers, the donors, the surrogates, I don't believe that there's ever been an effort in our party that can compare with what you have done over these past years. Thank you so very much.
Governor Mitt Romney conceding the presidency to Barack Obama.
And in Chicago, to the strains of Stevie Wonder's Signed, Sealed, Delivered, the president delivered his acceptance speech. He spoke at his campaign headquarters in his hometown of Chicago.
Tonight,
More than 200 years after a former colony won the right to determine its own destiny, the task of perfecting our union moves forward. It moves forward because of you. It moves forward because you reaffirmed the spirit that has triumphed over war and depression, the spirit that has lifted this country from the depths of despair to the great heights of hope, the belief that while each of us will pursue our own individual dreams, we are an American family and we rise or fall together as one nation and as one people.
And President Obama congratulated his opponent and praised him after a long, bitter contest.
I just spoke with Governor Romney and I congratulated him and Paul Ryan on a hard-fought campaign. We may have battled fiercely, but it's only because we love this country deeply and we care so strongly about its future. From George to Lenore to their son Mitt, the Romney family has chosen to give back to America through public service, and that is a legacy that we honor and applaud tonight.
The president did highlight some of his key accomplishments, like health care reform and the death of Osama bin Laden, but with the election now over, he struck a bipartisan tone.
And whether I earned your vote or not, I have listened to you. I have learned from you. And you've made me a better president. And with your stories and your struggles, I return to the White House more determined and more inspired than ever about the work there is to do and the future that lies ahead. Tonight, you voted for action, not politics as usual. You elected us to focus on your jobs, not ours. And in the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together, reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do.
The president concluded his remarks by bringing back a buzzword from his 2008 campaign, hope, though he qualified it after 4 years of contentious Washington politics.
And tonight, despite all the hardship we've been through, despite all the frustrations of Washington, I've never been more hopeful about our future. I have never been more hopeful about America. And I ask you to sustain that hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism, the kind of hope that just ignores the enormity of the tasks ahead or the roadblocks that stand in our path. I'm not talking about the wishful idealism that allows us to just sit on the sidelines or shirk from a fight. I have always believed that hope is that stubborn thing inside us that insists, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that something better awaits us, so long as we have the courage to keep reaching, to keep working, to keep fighting. America, I believe we can build on the progress we've made and continue to fight for new jobs and new opportunity and new security for the middle class. I believe we can keep the promise of our founding, the idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or what you look like or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try. I believe we can seize this future together because we are not as divided as our politics suggests. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. We are, and forever will be, the United States of America. And together, with your help and God's grace, we will continue our journey forward and remind the world just why it is that we live in the greatest nation on earth. Thank you, America. God bless you. God bless these United States.
That's President Obama speaking earlier this evening in response to his reelection.
And remarkable, if you think about it, Adi, it's been, how many years since this campaign season began? And just a few days ago, people weren't sure if President Obama would be reelected. He wasn't only reelected, but handily reelected. It appears as if he will have at least 303 electoral votes. And if he wins Florida, which appears possible, he could have more than 330 electoral votes. This is the third time, let me just confirm this, this is the third time that the U.S., the voters in the United States have elected three two-term presidents in a row. The last time it happened, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe.
And probably a hint why, as President Obama was going up onto the stage, someone hit send on a donation letter. So we got an email in our inbox. I'm about to speak to the crowd here in Washington, but I wanted to thank you first. Of course, that big donate button at the end, it says a lot about the campaign and the ground game and the fundraising. Ken Rudin, asking you to jump in here a little bit. What did you hear in the tone of both of these speeches?
Well, certainly when it comes to President Obama, it reminded me a lot of his 2004 Democratic Convention speech when he talked about one America, not Democrats, not Republicans, not red states and not blue states.
But more gray since then, looking
up
on the
screen. Well, certainly more gray. But the thing is, he's talking about his optimism is maybe about the American people, but is it about Congress? And he's still coming in with a Republican House, a Democratic Senate, and, of course, it's a Democratic Senate with not 60 votes, and so it's much harder to get things done. And you just wonder that, we think of President Bush in 2004 talking about, I've earned this political capital, and now I'm going to use it. Whereas President Obama seemed to be more optimistic, but is he optimistic about getting things through Congress? And that's a question mark.
We'll talk more about that next phase. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 from NPR News. Please head over to our website, npr.org, the It's All Politics blog. Lots more stuff for you guys there going into the morning.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We're going to take a moment to listen to some of the victory speeches we heard this evening.
A key Senate race was decided early. Democrat Joe Donnelly defeated Republican Richard Murdoch in the Indiana race for Senate. He'll take longtime Republican Senator Richard Lugar's seat.
Murdoch surprised Republicans when he beat Senator Lugar in the primary, but then stumbled late in the campaign with controversial comments about rape. Donnelly address his supporters in Indianapolis.
This is about our future, the chance for good jobs, to see our economy grow, to work together in Washington. We can solve these problems. We can solve the budget deficit problem. We can solve the problem of making sure our men and women come home from Afghanistan. And let me tell you, we have the best soldiers, airmen, Marines, Navy, Coast Guard, Merchant Marine in the world. And we owe a debt of gratitude to them that we can never repay.
In Arizona, Republican Congressman Jeff Flake defeated Democratic challenger Richard Carmona. He'll take John Kyle's Senate seat.
I can tell you that decisions are going to have to be made that won't be popular. Not every vote I cast will be popular. But I can guarantee you that every vote I cast, every decision I make, will be made knowing what's at stake and knowing that this state has to have a brighter future and those who live in it. That Arizona's sunsets will always be eclipsed by the sunrise in the next morning. That we can have a better future for our kids and our grandkids than we have had. That's what I'm going to do in Washington. Thank you for sending me there. Thank you for electing me to the U.S. Senate. Thank you.
And in Ohio, voters have returned Democrat Sherrod Brown to his Senate seat. He defeated Republican challenger Josh Mandel. Brown spoke to his supporters in Columbus, Ohio.
At the beginning of this speech, I said the middle class won today. The middle class is not just the economic middle of this country. Most of us in this country think of ourselves as middle class. It's the values we share. It's the principles we believe in. It's the opportunities we create for our children. It's the hard work we do every day. It's the businesses we build. This race was never really about my opponent or me. It was about the veteran. Thank you.
And you can hear his voice breaking there. Moments later, Senator Sherrod Brown stepped aside and let his wife finish his speech for him.
And we're going to turn to Ron Elving and Ken Rune, that ragged liberal voice, somehow symbolic coming out of this election. What about this next agenda? I mean, what really can happen looking at a Congress that pretty much looks the same as the last time and it was pretty deadlocked?
Nothing could happen. One thing that is quite a real possibility is that we just get right back into the same old gridlock. I don't see a breakthrough in the Senate adding a Democrat or two. I and possibly just staying where we were. I don't see a big breakthrough in the House where the Republicans at this point might be giving up a few seats from what they had, but we're projecting something like 238 seats. That's 20 over the majority. And John Boehner, the Speaker, is going to say, we've been vindicated. Exactly the way we've acted the last 2 years is apparently fine with our constituents in 238 districts.
Ken Rudin, do you see President Obama taking a more aggressive approach to House Republicans? He was criticized in 2010 for not doing that, for being too conciliatory. Some said that was one of the reasons why Democrats lost the House. Do you see the president becoming more aggressive, maybe even more confrontational?
Well, but of course, every step that President Obama makes to be more controversial and confrontational, I would think that the Republicans may
push back,
respond in kind. First of all, the Republicans for the longest time thought they had President Obama, you know, in their grasp. They thought they had him won. The polls earlier showed him very unpopular. The unemployment rate was over 8% for most of his term, and no president has ever been reelected with an unemployment that high. But as the economic situation seemed to improve, his numbers improved as well, and the Republicans just had to sit back and just watch it happen.
But you have to note in the speech for Senate-elect Jeff Flake, where he says, not every vote I make will be popular. Yeah. Now, I know he's a guy who he doesn't necessarily have popular votes, but it sounded vaguely like I'm ready to get into the Senate and do a little deal making, which is sort of meaningful going into the next
Flake
few months.
Well, Flake is like that. Flake, as a matter of fact, has taken on his own party as much as he's challenged the Democrats. And Flake is known for battling entitlements and things like that, and The kind of programs that the Democrats and Republicans have been passing for decades.
Very anti-pork and barrel spending.
Absolutely.
That's his big thing.
And, you know, and Flake has been known for that. So there are some Democrats. Look, we're losing the Olympia Snows. We're losing the Ben Nelsons, those who speak across the aisle. But, you know, it remains to be seen how many remain of those kind.
Ron Elving, we've got about 2 minutes left to go in our election special coverage. It's been a long, long more than a year of campaigning. What are your final thoughts? It's coming to an end, nostalgic. It's all over.
This has been an extraordinary period of time in that we have traveled so extraordinarily far in order to get back where we began. And $6 billion have been expended. 1 million ads have been aired. I think the American people may very well have been overexposed to politics for the last 18 months. And I think there's every chance that they would like some relief and they would like something very different from Washington in the next 18 months to 24 months.
And I have good news for Abigail Evans. It's finally over.
No more Bronco
Obama, and it's over. And Big Bird must be happy as well.
Big Bird, big smile on Big Bird's
You know,
face.
We talk about all the states, all the millions of people who were involved in this election, but only voters in 8 or 9 states were the really ones who paid attention or who got the respect and the attention from the candidates. Most of the people just sat back and watched as if it was a spectator sport.
Of course, they also had to watch the million ads.
Yeah, indeed they did. Audie, feeling nostalgic?
Not yet. I mean, it's a little early in the night to feel nostalgic. I mean, we're still looking at the board of those 1 or 2 states, especially in the
left.
House.
Not
yeah,
too many
that
left.
Are not too many, but
most of it's been resolved.
Definitely, it's been a long, long race. So definitely,
2016 starts tonight.
It starts tonight, indeed.
Is.
Oh
it
gosh,
is.
And it's been a long night for all of us here at NPR working the election. Ron Elving, Ken Rudin. Thank you so much for being with us. You've been listening to special live coverage here on NPR, coverage of the 2012 election results. Earlier in the evening, we had Robert Siegel and Melissa Block. For the past few hours, it's been me and Audie Cornish.
Bringing up the rear.
Thanks. It's been fun. Thanks so much for listening. Go to our website, npr.org, to check on the latest results and more in-depth analysis. And, of course, tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow morning, or this morning, actually. Thanks for listening.